For just as the body is one and has many parts, and all the parts of the body, even though there are many, are one body, so too is Christ. After calming them with the understanding that the gift was a generous favor, that they received everything from the same Spirit, that it was given for everyone's benefit, that even the smaller gifts were received as a revelation. And moreover, having also silenced their obligation to submit to the Spirit's authority, he now continues to comfort them in a similar manner, using another common example, and refers back to nature itself, as was his habit. When he was discussing the topic of men's and women's hair, he drew from it a lesson of correction, saying, "Doesn't even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him, but if a woman has long hair, it's a glory to her?" While addressing the subject of idol sacrifices and forbidding to touch them, he referenced examples from secular society, even citing the Olympic Games, saying, "Everyone who competes in the Games goes into strict training, but only one gets the prize." He substantiated his views with analogies from shepherds, soldiers, and farmers. That's why he uses a common analogy here to argue and insist that no one is truly left in worse shape. It's astonishing and impressive to be able to demonstrate this, and it serves to reassure those who feel inferior, in other words, the analogy of the body. There's nothing more comforting to individuals who feel inferior or less gifted, or more persuasive to stop them grieving, than the realization they're not given less than their fair share. That is why Paul, to illustrate this point, put it this way: "For just as the body is one and has many members," do you see his precise thinking? He's pointing out that the same thing can be both one and many. Hence, he also adds, stressing the point more strongly, "And all the members of the one body, though many, are one body." He didn't say, "though many are part of one body," but "the one body itself is composed of many, and those various members make up this one thing. So if the one is many and the many are one, where is the difference? Where is the superiority? Where is the disadvantage? For all," he says, "are one. And not just simply one, but when thoroughly examined in terms of the most crucial aspect, that is, their being a body, they all are found to be one. But when examined as to their specific characteristics, then the difference emerges, and the difference is in all alike. No single one of them can make a body on its own, but each is equally deficient in composing a body, and there's a need for unification, since when the many become one, then and only then is there one body." Thus, subtly indicating this very thing, he said, "And all the members of the one body, even though many, are one body." And he did not say the superior and the inferior, but "though many," which applies to all. And how can they possibly be one? When you disregard the differences in the parts, you consider the body as a whole. For what the eye is, so is the foot, in regard to being a part and constituting a body. There's no difference in this respect. You can't say that one part forms a body on its own, but another does not. For they are all equal in this, specifically because they all form one body. However, having stated this and having made it clear according to everyone's consensus, he further added, "So too is Christ." And though he should have said, "So too is the church," as this was the logical implication, he didn't say it, but rather slipped in Christ's name in place of it, lifting up the conversation and gradually invoking the listener's respect. But his intention is this: "So also is the body of Christ, which is the church." Just like the body and the head comprise one person, so he said that the church and Christ are one. This is why he substituted church with Christ, attributing that name to his body. He continues, "Just as our body is a single unit despite being composed of many components, so too in the church we all unify into one. Even though the church consists of many followers, these many form a single body." So, as you see, having encouraged and uplifted the person who felt belittled using this universal example, he veers away from the subject of common experience. Next, he turns to another, a spiritual one, providing greater comfort and suggesting significant equal honor. Now, what is this? Verse 13. "For in one Spirit," he says, "we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether bond or free." Now, his point is this: that which made us into one body and reborn us is one Spirit. For it's not that one was baptized in one Spirit and another in a different one, And it's not only the one who has baptized us that is one, but also the purpose for which he baptized us, that is, the reason he baptized us, is one. For we were baptized not so that many separate bodies might be formed, but so that we might all maintain with one another the perfect nature of one body. In other words, that we might all be one body, this is why we were baptized. So both the one who created it is singular, and that into which he formed it is also singular. And he did not say that we might all become part of the same body, but rather that we might all be one body, because he always strives to use the most powerful expressions. And he was right to say, we all, including himself. Even I, the apostle, possess no more than you in this regard, he says. For you are the body just as much as I am, and I am just as much as you are, and we all share the same head and have undergone the same suffering. Consequently, we are also the same body. And why do I only mention the Jews, he states, when even the Gentiles, who were so far away from us, he has brought into the complete unity of one body? So after saying we all, he didn't stop there, but added, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slave or free. Now, if we were united and became one, even though we were initially far apart, we have no reason to be upset or depressed. Indeed, the difference is essentially irrelevant. For if he has granted the same blessings to Greeks and Jews, slaves and free people, how can it be that he divides them, now that he has provided a greater unity through his gifts? And all were made to drink of one spirit. For the body is not one part, but many. We have arrived at the same initiation, we partake in the same table. And why didn't he say, we are nourished by the same body and drink the same blood? Because by stating spirit, he communicated both, the flesh as well as the blood. For through both, we are made to drink of the Spirit. But to me, he seems now to discuss that interaction of the Spirit which occurs in us after baptism and before the mysteries. And he said, we were made to drink, because this metaphorical language was extremely fitting for his intended topic, as if he had spoken about plants in a garden where all the trees are watered by the same fountain or by the same water. So too here, we all drank the same Spirit, we enjoyed the same grace, he says. If now one Spirit both formed us and brought us all together into one body, for this is the intention of we were baptized into one body, and granted us one table, and gave us all the same nourishment, and united individuals so vastly separated, and if many things then become a body when they are unified, why, I ask, are you constantly highlighting our differences? But if you say, because there are many members and diverse, understand that this very thing is the wonder and the unique excellence of the body when the things which are many and diverse become one. But if they were not many, it wouldn't be so wonderful and incredible that they should be one body. In fact, they wouldn't be a body at all. However, he mentions this last, but currently he addresses the members themselves, saying this, if the foot should say, because I'm not the hand, I am not part of the body, does it mean it's not part of the body? And if the ear were to say, because I am not the eye, I am not part of the body, is it for that reason not part of the body? For if one part is seen as lesser and another as greater, it doesn't invalidate their belonging to the same body. Rather, the body ceases to exist altogether. Therefore, don't assert, I am not part of the body because I am lesser. Consider that the foot holds a lower position, yet it is still part of the body. Whether or not it forms part of the body isn't determined by where it is placed, but by whether it is connected or detached. The way to establish whether something is or isn't bodily is based upon whether it is unified or separated. But I urge you, take note of this thoughtful approach that applies their words to our own members. As he previously stated, I have applied these things to myself and Apollos in a metaphorical way. So too does he here create a persuasive and non-confrontational argument by attributing speech to our body parts. When they hear nature's own response and are caught by their own experiences and widespread agreement, they will have no more objections. For say what you will, he argues, or complain as much as you like, you cannot remove yourself from the body. Nature's laws secure this, and even more so does the power of grace guard and preserve everything in its entirety. Notice how he avoids excess. He doesn't craft his argument around all the parts, but on the two extremes, the most esteemed, the eye, and the least, the feet. He doesn't have the foot arguing with the eye, but rather with the hand, which is slightly higher, and the ear with the eyes. Since we are more likely to envy those who are slightly above us rather than those far superior, the comparison is made this way. If the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? If the whole body were hearing, where would the smelling be? Thus, because he pointed out the differences among the members, such as feet, hands, eyes, and ears, he guided them to realize their own inferiority and superiority. Observe how he comforts them again, hinting that it was necessary, and the fact that they are many and diverse is precisely what makes them a body. But if they all were the same, they wouldn't be a body. Therefore, he says, if they were all one member, where would the body be? However, he doesn't mention this until later, but here he also highlights something more, that besides the impossibility of anyone being a body, it even eliminates the existence of the rest. For if the whole were hearing, where would the smelling be? He says. Then, because even after all this, they were still unsettled. What he had done before, he does now again. For just as in that instance he first presented the benefits to console them, and then forcefully said, but all these activities the one and the same spirit executes, dividing to each individual separately as he wishes. So here also, after providing reasons why he illustrated that it's beneficial for everyone to be this way, he once again attributes everything to God's plan, saying, but now God has placed each one of the members in the body just as he desired. Just as he referred to the Spirit, saying, as he desires, similarly here, as it pleased him. Now don't delve deeper into why things are the way they are. Even if we could provide countless reasons, we would not be as effective in explaining that everything is properly done as when we say, just as it pleased the perfect craftsman, so it happened. After all, what needs to happen? He wills it. Now, if we avoid over-questioning the workings of our own body, we should do so even more in the church. Notice his thoughtfulness in not discussing the difference arising from their nature or function, but from their position. As he says, now, God has placed each member in the body exactly as it pleased him. And his wording, each one, highlights the significance of all parts. This means you can't argue, he positioned this, but not that. Every piece is placed exactly as he wished, meaning it's beneficial for the foot to be placed where it is, and not just the head, and if it were to change its position for another, even if it seemed like a beneficial move, it would lead to confusion and destruction of the whole. Indeed, it would lose its original place and not reach the other. Verse 19, and if they were all one body part, where would the body be? Verse 20, but now they are many body parts, but one body. Having efficiently silenced them by God's own plan, he once again presents arguments. He neither always does this nor that, but he switches and varies his speech. Because on one hand, someone who only silences can confuse the listener, and on the other hand, one who consistently demands rationalization for everything can harm their faith. Therefore, Paul continually uses both strategies so that they can both believe without being confused, and after silencing them, he also provides reasoning once more. Note his commitment in the struggle and the totality of his triumph, for from the very things they perceived themselves to be unequal in honor due to their great variation, he demonstrates that for this very reason they have equal honor. How, I will tell you. If all were one member, he says, where would the body be? What he's saying is that without great diversity among you, you couldn't be a body. And if you're not a body, you couldn't be one. And if you're not one, you couldn't be equal in honor. Hence it follows that if you were all equal in honor, you wouldn't be a body. And if you're not a body, you wouldn't be one. And if you're not one, how could you be equal in honor? However, because you don't all possess the same gift, therefore you are a body. And being a body, you are all one, and there's no difference between you in the fact that you are a body. So this very difference is what primarily creates your equality in honor. And thus, he adds, but now there are many members, yet one body. Therefore, let's consider these things and eliminate all envy. We shouldn't bear any grudge against those who possess greater gifts, nor look down on those with lesser abilities. God has willed it this way, so let's not resist it. If you still feel discomforted, remember that oftentimes you're able to perform work that your brother cannot. This therefore makes you superior in one aspect, despite you feeling inferior in others. Even if he seems greater, from this perspective, he has a disadvantage, thus bringing about equality. Like how in the human body, the smaller parts may seem insignificant, but their absence can severely affect the larger parts. For instance, the hair may seem trivial, but if you remove it from the eyebrows or eyelids, it significantly alters the appearance of the face and the beauty of the eyes. Even such a minor loss can distort the visual appeal and hinder the eye's function. The reason being, each of our body parts has both a unique function and a commonfold role. Similarly, in our body there's both a unique beauty and a shared beauty. Though distinct, these types of beauty are intertwined. The distortion of one ruins the other. To elaborate, bright eyes, a smiling face, red lips, a straight nose, an open brow all contribute to beauty. But if you damage even the tiniest of these, you ruin the overall aesthetic. All the allure fades away, and what was once beautiful becomes repugnant. For instance, crushing just the tip of the nose can bring great deformity. Impairing just this one part affects the whole. The same goes for the hand. Removing the nail from one finger disturbs the equilibrium of beauty. In terms of function as well, remove one finger and you'll find the rest cannot perform as efficiently as before. Since then, the loss of a member is a usual impairment, and its safety is beauty to everyone. Let's not be arrogant, nor look down on our neighbors. For through that small part, even the larger one is improved and attractive, and by the eyelids, minor as they are, the eye is beautified, so that he who fights with his brother fights with himself, for the harm done reaches not only to that one, but he himself also will endure significant loss. To prevent this, then, let's care for our neighbors, as we would for ourselves, and let's extend this understanding to the church as well, caring for all its members. The church, after all, is diverse, with some members more privileged and some less so. For instance, there are groups of virgins, gatherings of widows, and societies of those in holy matrimony. In short, there are many levels of virtue. And this is true for charity as well. Some donate all they have. Some merely maintain the essentials and ask for nothing more. Some give from their excess. Regardless, all these individuals enrich one another. And if those with more were to disregard those with less, they would do themselves the most harm. For example, suppose a virgin looks down on a married woman. She would lose a significant portion of her reward. And a person who has given up all they have, if they were to criticize one who hasn't done the same, they would lose much of the reward of their sacrifice. Why only talk about virgins, widows, and men without possessions? What could be humbler than those who beg? Yet even beggars play a significant role in the church, clinging to the sanctuary doors and providing an essential service, and without them, the church won't be complete. This, it seems, was recognized by the apostles who early on mandated the existence of widows within the church, appointing deacons to oversee them. They are included amongst the ranks of bishops, presbyters, deacons, virgins, and nuns in my tally of church members. Their role is by no means insignificant. While we attend the church as we please, they are there day and night, singing hymns and praying, and not just for charity. Their faith is genuine. Despite their dire poverty, you'll never hear them blaspheme or complain like many rich men's wives often do. Some of them go to sleep hungry, and others suffer from relentless cold, yet they spend their days in gratitude and praise. Even if you give them a penny, they're thankful and shower the giver with blessings. And if you give nothing, they won't complain, but will still bless you, feeling fortunate just to have enough for daily needs. Yes, comes the reply, since they must bear it, whether they want to or not. But why? Tell me. Why have you made this harsh statement? Aren't there disgraceful ways and means that can provide elderly men and women with money? Couldn't they have comfortably supported themselves through such methods, if only they decided to let go of their moral living? Don't you see how many people of that age, by indulging in activities like soliciting and pandering, and by other such services, not only get by, but live in luxury? But these people prefer to die of hunger rather than tarnish their life and jeopardize their salvation. And they spend all day crafting a remedy for your salvation. No doctor who extends their hand to wield a scalpel can act as effectively to remove the corruption from our wounds as does a poor man who extends his right hand to receive charity to erase the scars left by those wounds. And what's truly wonderful, they perform this remarkable surgery without causing pain or distress. And we, who lead the people and give you such sound advice, are no more truthful in our discourse than he who sits at the doors of the church with his silence and expression. Indeed, we echo these same sentiments to you every day, saying, "Do not be arrogant, human. Human nature is fragile and always on the brink of decline. Our youth rushes towards old age, our beauty towards ugly, our strength to weakness, our honor to disgrace, our health deteriorates into sickness, our glory to humiliation, our wealth to poverty. Our life is like a fast-flowing river that never stays still, but keeps rushing down the slope." They give the same advice, and more indeed, from their appearance and their actual experience, which offers even clearer advice. Consider, for instance, how many of those now fallen were once in the prime of youth and did great things. How many of these sordid-looking individuals once outshone many others in physical strength and facial beauty. Don't dismiss or mock this, for life abounds with countless such examples. If often from people of lowly and humble origins many have risen to become kings, isn't it less surprising that those who were great and glorious have been reduced to humble and lowly positions? The former is indeed far more extraordinary, while the latter happens all too often. So one should not doubt that any of these people ever excelled in arts, warfare, and wealth, but instead we should pity them deeply and fear for ourselves, lest we too suffer the same fate one day, for we too are humans and thus subject to such rapid change. But perhaps someone who is careless and used to ridicule might object to what has been said and will entirely mock us, saying, "How long will you continue presenting poor men and beggars in your discourses and prophesying misfortunes to us, declaring impending poverty and aiming to turn us into beggars?" I'm not saying these things to turn you into beggars, but rather I'm eager to open the riches of heaven for you. Just as someone who, to the healthy man, mentions the sick and recounts their suffering, doesn't do it to make him ill, but to keep him healthy, by the fear of their miseries curbing his carelessness. You see poverty as a terrible thing, that it should be feared even in name alone. Yes, we are poor because we fear poverty, even though we may have 10,000 talents. For the one who has nothing isn't poor, but the one who dreads poverty. In people's misfortunes, it's not those who suffer greatly whom we pity and consider miserable, but those who don't know how to handle their troubles, even if they're small. The one who knows how to handle these is praiseworthy and deserving of accolades. To prove this, who do we cheer in the games? Those who take a beating without getting upset, maintaining a strong stand, or those who run after the first few hits? Aren't those who continue fighting crowned by us as brave and noble, while we scoff at those who run as cowards? Let's follow the same approach in life. Let's celebrate the one who bears all troubles with ease, as we do the brave champion, but feel sorrowful for the one who recoils and is terrified of challenges, and who experiences terror even before being hit. Like in the games, if anyone flees at the mere sight of their opponent extending their right hand, even before the fight begins, they'll be ridiculed as weak, effeminate, and inexperienced in such conflicts. This is similar to those who fear poverty and can't even bear the mere anticipation of it. Clearly, then, it is not we that make you miserable, but you yourselves. For how can it be that the devil should not from now on mock you, seeing you shaking in fear even before the strike and trembling at the threat? Or rather, when you merely perceive this as a threat, he will no longer need to strike you, but leaving you to maintain your wealth, he will make you softer than any wax by the anticipation of it being taken away. This is because it is our nature, as it were, not to find the things we fear as terrifying after experiencing them, as before and while they are yet untested. Therefore, to stop you from gaining even this virtue, he keeps you in the peak of fear, melting you down like wax in the fire with the fear of poverty, before you've even experienced it. Indeed, a person like that is softer than any wax and lives a life more miserable than Cain himself. For the things he has in surplus, he fears. For the things he doesn't have, he grieves. And again, in regards to what he possesses, he trembles, carrying his wealth internally like a stubborn runaway slave and surrounded by who knows what variety of indescribable emotions. For indescribable desire and numerous fears and anxieties and trembling from all directions stir them up, They are like a ship being tossed by conflicting winds from every direction and enduring many violent waves. And how much better for such a person to perish than to be enduring a continuous storm? For even Cain would have found it more bearable to have died than to be forever trembling. Should we then risk suffering these things on our part? Let's ridicule the tricks of the devil. Let's break his chains. Let's cut off the tip of his terrifying spear and strengthen every barrier. For if you scoff at money, he has nowhere to hit. He has nowhere he can seize. Then you've uprooted the root of evils, and when the root is gone, no evil fruit will grow. Okay, these are the things we constantly say and never stop saying. But whether our words have any effect, the day will reveal it, the day that is revealed by fire, which tests every man's work. 1 Cor 3:13. That day will show which lamps are bright and which are not. Then the person who has oil and the person who doesn't will be evident, but I hope none will be found lacking comfort at that time. Rather may all, bringing in with them an ample amount of mercy, and having their lamps brightly lit, enter together with the bridegroom. Since there is nothing more terrifying and full of distress than the voice which those who left without giving abundant alms shall hear from the bridegroom, "I don't know you." But may we never hear this voice, but rather the most joyful and desirable one. Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For in this way we will live a happy life and enjoy all the blessings which even surpass human understanding, to which may we all reach through grace and mercy, etc.